From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. DNA led police in California to the man they believe to be the Golden State Killer, who had raped and murdered and robbed his way around California in the 1970s and 80s. The cops had his DNA, but no matches in their databanks. So they went to a commercial genealogy website where people like you upload their DNA to find their roots. Last week, decades after their leads had grown cold, they announced they had their man and arrested him. Here's John Blackstone with CBS.
Investigators confirmed they identified Joseph DeAngelo using an unnamed private genealogy website, combing through DNA on family trees to find distant relatives. When DeAngelo was identified last week as a possible suspect, investigators watched his home and collected two samples of what they called discarded DNA, made a positive identification, leading to his arrest.
So that's some great police work, but what about privacy rights? This hour on Point, catching the Golden State Killer, and who's doing what with your genetic profile? You can join us on air or online. What does this case say about privacy concerns? Are you concerned that law enforcement and other entities can search your DNA, your family's DNA, without your knowledge? Did you think of that before you sent your sample into Ancestry.com? Join us anytime at OnPointRadio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPointRadio. And joining me now from Sacramento is Sam Stanton, senior writer for the Sacramento Bee. He's been covering the arrest of the Golden State Killer, and you can find a link to his latest reporting on our website, OnPointRadio.org. Sam, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you. Can you remind us of the background of this story? Just tell us a little bit about the Golden State Killer who terrorized California for all those years. Tell us a little bit about that case.
Well, this goes back 44 years. It's been a mystery all this time. And this suspect was known by a series of names. It started with the Visalia Ransacker, named after someone who committed a series of burglaries in the Central Valley community of Visalia. And then it turned into the East Area Rapist case here in Sacramento, where there were approximately 37 sexual assaults and two murders, most of them centered in a cluster in the eastern side of the city. He was also called the original Night Stalker and the Golden State Killer. So what we're dealing with here, the authorities suspect, is a total of 12 murders the length of California, 51 rapes, and more than 100 burglaries.
Wow, so it's quite a crime. And as we mentioned, the leads had grown cold, and now they have a suspect, James DeAngelo. Tell us how the police used this publicly accessible genealogy website called GEDmatch, G-E-D Match. Tell us about how that worked.
It's actually Joseph DeAngelo, and what happened is a distant relative of his apparently went to Ancestry or one of these genealogical websites and submitted their DNA to search their family tree. That information then was loaded by that individual onto GEDmatch, which is an open source genealogical website where you can submit your DNA to try and search for your relatives, where you come from, that type of thing. The authorities here in Sacramento had DNA from two of the murders in Ventura County, as well as some of the murders in Orange County. And they took that DNA and plugged it into the GEDmatch website in what they said was a Hail Mary effort. And what they came up with was kind of a match. And they looked at that and they thought, let's follow this. So they started following that family tree, and they were able to, you know, eliminate all the women on that side of the tree, eliminated people who weren't the right age range. And bit by bit, it led them to DeAngelo, they say. And they started to look at his background. He'd been a police officer in two communities here in California. And he was living smack dab in the middle of this cluster where the assaults occurred. And so they started watching him. And as he discarded a couple of items, they picked them up for DNA samples. They ran two of those samples. And after the second sample, they said, this is our guy, and they moved immediately. They arrested him the next day.
Wow. That's really something. So, I mean, DNA evidence is used all the time to implicate criminals. But what's different about this case is that the police used a free, publicly accessible genealogy database. Is that right? Is that one of the things that separates this case out in a way?
Right. And one of the issues that I'm sure will be coming up in the courtroom is the fact that when they went into the site, they used a made-up name. They didn't say, we're with the police, we want this information. They just entered, you know, a name that they came up with. You could do the same. This is an open, free website that you can sign into at any time. And so you have to expect that the defense is going to challenge that DNA evidence as they proceed to trial.
Hmm. So that's a big question. What else remains unanswered about this case? I mean, what questions do you have as a reporter who's been following it for some time?
Well, there are two huge questions. One is, did he stop in 1986, or did he change his MO and continue? Because the authorities have always said that this crime spree ran from 74 until May of 1986, but they don't know. They also haven't been able to establish what he was doing during a 10-year window from the early 1970s until he took a job here in Sacramento, and how he was, if D'Angelo is actually the man they're looking for, how he was able to move around the state. They don't know if he was a truck driver or how he could have committed these crimes from Northern to Southern California.
Really interesting. Well, Sam Stanton, senior writer for the Sacramento Bee, talking about the arrest of the Golden State Killer last week in California. Sam, thanks so much for joining us today. We're really grateful for your time.
Happy to do it.
All right. Well, we've got some great experts to talk to as well about this. I want to introduce Jennifer Wagner. She's an associate director for bioethics research and a professor at the Center for Translational Bioethics and Healthcare Policy at the Geislinger Health System, and she joins us from State College, Pennsylvania. Jen, it's good to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Also with me is Stephen Mercer, lawyer and law professor who has worked for two decades in DNA forensics and civil liberties. He was chief attorney for the forensics divisions for Maryland's Public Defender's Office, and he led the effort to ban familial searching in Maryland and the District of Columbia. Stephen Mercer, good to have you as well.
Thank you. Hi, Anthony.
Jen Wagner, let me start with you. What sets this particular case, the arrest of the Golden State Killer, using this publicly accessible genealogy database apart from other DNA cases? What stands out to you?
Well, I mean, I think that the important part is that they did what any individual could do. They went to a publicly accessible database and uploaded a file and saw exactly the information that any other user would see. And so rather than using an official law enforcement database, they went to something that, you know, anyone in the public could use.
Mm. I mean, one of the themes that we're talking about this hour is privacy concerns. I mean, obviously, we want to applaud the police work, particularly if they indeed have caught this man who allegedly terrorized much of California for all that time. But does this raise privacy issues in your mind? And if so, what are they? Jen?
So for me, this is more a case about the data, not necessarily a DNA case. And some of my colleagues, like Elizabeth Joe, have said the same thing when they've spoken to reporters. You know, yes, it involves a genetic profile, but it's really about this big data world and what privacy we can expect when so much of our lives are digital and so much of our lives are in the hands of companies and other entities. So I think that in that regard, it does raise privacy concerns. I think it also this case also brings up issues related to what do people understand when they actually go in and use these services. So there are plenty of disclosures in terms of service that the companies, whether they're testing DNA or just allowing you to, you know, poke around and compare your profiles with others, you know, provide to users. But how many of us really read them? You know, we click through and say yes.
Right.
And so the genuine understanding is, I think, a major concern and something that bioethicists have been talking about for literally decades. So I think this case is interesting in that it has actually, you know, caused a public discussion about, you know, what is a reasonable expectation of privacy in this realm.
Really interesting set of questions. Stephen Mercer, you know, interesting to note that this story comes so quickly following the Cambridge Analytical scandal, in which Facebook data on more than 70 million users was shared without permission. I mean, this is the world we live in now of big data. What stands out to you from this case?
Well, DNA identification does raise important big data privacy issues, but it also raises issues unique to DNA. DNA is a container of our intensely personal information. It's our human essence. It's the thing that makes us special and unique. And genetic privacy connotes control over access to that information. And what's special about DNA is that it reveals family relationships, which are at the core of our privacy concerns. And so, you know, what legal rules should apply in a situation where law enforcement create a dummy user account, upload an ancestry DNA profile, and search for relatives who are then targeted for further investigation?
Yeah, so really troubling. So I guess one of the big questions, and I think Jen Wagner put her finger on this, Stephen Mercer, is, you know, if someone spits into a tube and sends it off to Ancestry.com to learn something about their ancestry, that's all well and good. But do they really understand what else they're getting into in terms of what is going to be done with their DNA, right? I mean, their DNA profile.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, if I send in my DNA to learn about my ancestry, I do not expect that the swab patrol are going to show up tomorrow to investigate my children.
All right. Well, listen, stand by. Jen Wagner, Stephen Mercer, when we come back, we're going to be talking about your DNA profile, listeners. Who has it? Why that may be a concern. You can join the conversation. Is this the old story? If you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to worry about. Or is there something to worry about?
We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of NPR's Embedded, and we've got a new episode all about how Scott Pruitt ended up running the EPA. It's a story about Pruitt's life in the Southern Baptist Church, how he handled a major pollution case, and why he sued the EPA 14 times. Just search for Embedded on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the arrest of the alleged Golden State Killer and what it tells us about the use of DNA and ancestry websites in the marketplace and in law enforcement. You can join the conversation. Have you uploaded your DNA onto one of those registries? Did you think your DNA profile would be kept private or made available to anyone else? Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and at On Point Radio. In a commercial for Ancestry DNA in 2016, a woman named Livy talks about how learning about her genealogy changed how she identified herself.
People would ask me in different countries that we traveled, what is your nationality? And I would always answer Hispanic. So when I got my Ancestry DNA results, it was a shocker. I'm everything. I'm from all nations. I would look at forms now and wonder, what do I mark? Because I'm everything, and I marked other.
And in this commercial for the genetic testing and analysis service 23andMe, users describe how the process works.
You spit to the fill line in this tube.
Close funnel.
Okay. You're supposed to close this.
And detach funnel. And then screw on cap. Mail-in kit.
You'll know your history in 6 weeks.
All right. Well, I've got some great experts on the implications of these ever-growing commercial DNA databanks. Jennifer Wagner is Associate Director for Bioethics Research and a professor at the Center for Translational Bioethics and Healthcare Policy at Geisinger Health System. And she joins us from State College, Pennsylvania. Also, Stephen Mercer is with us, lawyer and law professor who has worked for two decades on DNA forensics and civil liberties. Jen and Stephen, let me start this section with a couple of comments from our listeners on Facebook. Grant Cook writes, "You give it up to a third party, it's in the public domain. You can't expect privacy after willingly giving it up." But here's Tanya Yetter writing, "I'm more concerned about my insurance company getting hold of my DNA test. They'll then be able to exclude you for pre-existing conditions you don't even know you have yet." Stephen, let me start with you. On that concern about who gets to use and who gets to see and how this DNA profile might be used.
Well, first, in terms of what protections exist, there's large gaps in the current federal law that governs genetic information. Health insurance companies can't use it. Employers can't use it. But life insurance companies can, long-term disability insurance companies can. And what we're talking about here generally is control over access to one's genetic information. And the message from the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal is that when people share information for one intended purpose and then it's used for an entirely different purpose, that raises big privacy concerns because it shows that they're not controlling information that's personal to them.
Yeah, interesting. Jen Wagner, I'm looking at a statement from 23andMe, quote, "It's our policy to resist law enforcement inquiries to protect customer privacy. We have never given customer information to law enforcement officials." But then further on, there's a sort of transparency report, quote, "Under certain circumstances, personal information may be subject to disclosure pursuant to judicial or other government subpoenas, warrants, or riders." Comment on that. I mean, are those kinds of protections enough? And what about the laws? Are the laws keeping up with all of this?
Right. So I think Stephen was correct when he mentioned that there are gaps in the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. That's the federal statute. But there are plenty of state statutes that are out there to try to set additional protections depending on where you are. California, Florida, New Jersey, for example, all have laws. New Jersey's law actually does prohibit beyond health insurers from using that information against individuals. So it would make it it's against the law in New Jersey for life insurers to try to access that information. So I think that, yes, we can point to the limitations of the federal laws, but that doesn't mean that there's no protection out there. And it just means that we have to look in a number of different places, not only the state laws, but also administrative policies and the like, including the terms of service. And you just mentioned 23andMe's. I think that there are concerns about what kind of information we're talking about. The sites are not all identical. They're not all looking at the same thing. So, for example, the law enforcement databases are looking at specific locations in the genome that are non-coding. So they're not known to be causing certain conditions or traits that an individual has, whereas the direct-to-consumer companies like 23andMe and Ancestry.com, for example, they're looking at different parts of the genome. And even your healthcare institutions or your biomedical researchers, they're actually primarily looking at the coding regions, which is separate from what law enforcement would typically look at. And so I think it's important for us to think about the specificity, to think about the actual details of what's involved, what's reasonable in one instance might not be reasonable in another. So there are a lot of complex issues here. I think when we're trying to figure out, is the law keeping up, we need to think about whether people have actually challenged the laws and stress test them, so to speak.
And has that happened? And I mean, do we know about cases in which that's happened?
I mean, it's starting to happen. Right? I mean, with what law enforcement can do, and Stephen, I'm sure, will want to talk about this, the Maryland versus King case was, thinking about what can law enforcement do? Is it only analyze the genomes of convicted individuals, or are they able to make DNA fingerprinting a routine booking procedure for serious crimes?
All right.
So I think that you get this step by step, and we'll slowly start to see these cases pop up. Some will get public attention, and some won't, but they really serve as, in a way, our pilot data for setting broad policy.
Stephen, I want to ask you about that Maryland versus King case, but I want to get some callers in here. We've got a lot of them on the line who've been patiently waiting. Let's go to Wendy, who's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Wendy, you're on the air. It's good to have you.
Hi. Thank you. Hello, Anthony. I think I'm really glad you're connecting this with the Facebook situation because it's similar in the sense that your relatives submitted DNA and, then it's just like the data that was used from your friends. You didn't even agree to have it being used. I'm obviously very glad they caught the killer, but this does raise huge, in my mind, privacy problems because, if the killer himself had actually uploaded his DNA information into the database that they ended up using, then I'd say fine. He gave up his rights, or he, you know, some people want their information in the public realm to find relatives and so on and so forth. And that choice is theirs to make. And if he had done that and then he got caught, I'd say fine, no problem. But I really think that instead of having this complicated, your guests are describing very complicated laws, which DNA can be used, whether, you know, certain privacy issues come up or not. I truly believe we need an overall, you know, universal blanket legislation, or even potentially a constitutional amendment saying that our own DNA is our own. It is private to us individually to use as needed. Also, my personal feeling is that this also goes into an issue that came up many, many years ago when George W. Bush was president, as to cloning. You know, someday they'll be able to, you know, clone a new heart for me, or potentially a new lung or something. And I would like to have the control of that DNA and not have the state determining whether or not, you know, how that DNA is used, whether, you know, I want the control over my own.
Got it. Basically. Wendy, you put some great issues on the table. Stephen Mercer, I'd love to get you to respond, start out with the response to Wendy. I mean, I guess the sort of fundamental question here is DNA personal property?
Well, DNA is intensely personal. It's the essence of who we are. Mm. And, when we're talking about what is our DNA, we have to include not only our own individual DNA, but our family members' DNA, because we all, you know, people who are related swim in the same genetic swimming pool. And what the caller points out to and expresses a great concern over is the vast potential for misuse of DNA, as we find ourselves in the genesis of the DNA era, where the human genome, cracking it cost $3 billion 15 years ago, but can be done for $999 now and probably $100 in a couple of more years. Going back to Jen's earlier point, distinguishing law enforcement from private data banks, what they both do that's very alarming and relates to the caller's question is retain the DNA sample. Mm. Now, why is it that if you're having some ancestry testing done so you can take a fun trip to Italy and get some free wine from a third cousin, why does Ancestry have to keep your DNA sample? Well, they tell you why in their terms and conditions. It's so that they can subject it to future testing to develop products and services. And what are those products and services? We have private companies now that have amassed over 12 million DNA samples. There's been a boom in direct-to-consumer DNA testing. And these companies, these private companies that have these enormous data banks that are now rivaling the size of the law enforcement regulated data banks, are going to exert tremendous influence over the direction of research and applications of our expanding knowledge of the human genome.
It's really interesting. Jen, though, can you help me out with this question that the caller raised? The idea, I mean, Stephen, I take your point. DNA obviously is intensely personal, but what is the law? What have the courts said about this? Because I was reading about a Supreme Court case, Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics Incorporated, which found that DNA is not property? Is not
right.
Is that right? I mean,
yes,
go ahead.
DNA is not property, and courts have been very lax in this area because, you know, quite frankly, it's easy to applaud and celebrate the solving of a horrific crime. Courts have really equated DNA identification as though it is, lacking any privacy interest. Also have used pre-DNA era legal doctrines like standing to limit a defendant's ability to challenge a privacy violation of a family member whose DNA may be collected. So we're really in the Wild West right now as far as a lack of comprehensive regulation over the collection, retention, and sharing of DNA. And we're seeing this proliferation of unregulated law enforcement DNA databanks that are being operated at the local and state levels in the shadows of the regulated National Law Enforcement DNA Data Bank, and we're seeing this boom in private DNA data banks. And all of this should be profoundly concerning given the vast potential for misuse of DNA.
Wow. The Wild West. Let's go to Liz, who's calling from Pasadena, Maryland. Liz, you're on the air. It's good to have you. What are you thinking?
Hi, Anthony. I think there needs to be a distinction between private databases and public databases. It's very, very different when you submit your samples and you know it's going to be in the public domain. And I have no issue. If I had a second cousin that committed 50 rapes, I would want that person caught. And the people that had daughters that were murdered and people, I mean, that's the perfect use of data. And it's an open database. It's an open source database. Data has been collected for eons. We have birth certificates. We have records going back in Bibles. We have, this is just another way of catching criminals. And if you submit your DNA and it's out there in the public domain, then I have no problem with law enforcement using it. And that's what I wanted to say.
All right, Liz, I appreciate that. Let me go to Jen. Jen, what do you make of Liz's comment, this distinction between private and open databases? I mean, how do we make that distinction?
Yeah, I mean, I think that she's raising a very good point. I would caution us in using this term public domain when what we actually mean is something else. So we're talking about governmental databases, official databases like law enforcement uses, such as CODIS. And Stephen mentioned the local and the state level versions of those, or the shadow databases, as he referred to them. And then we also have industry databases, recreational databases that are not what I would call public. And I wouldn't call the data to be in the public domain, per se. And I think that kind of changes how we conceptualize the rights that we're talking about. But you had raised the point about DNA and personal property and have the courts decided that. And there is a case in Florida that's working its way through the court system that could potentially address that specifically. So when we're talking about DNA, that's potentially different from genetic information, right? The source material versus the data that come out of that mm-hmm. source material. And those are going to play out a little bit differently. And it all depends on what the parties bring to the courts to actually decide as the question before them. And that Florida case, hopefully will provide us some clarity. But in terms of the property considerations, with DNA, you literally share your genetic information to varying degrees with every other person on Earth, right? And you also shed skin cells, you shed hair every day. So there's a question about how you can control it. And that's why we've seen various state laws and other laws pop up that try to get at this non-consensual DNA testing and sharing of information. So we have surreptitious testing laws in certain locations. Now, typically, they have an exception for law enforcement, and that's basically to recognize that there are some situations where we would want the police to be able to use that information, even if we have some property rights in the data or privacy rights in those data. And so I think those are separate issues that we should consider. And then I do want to go back to, I believe it was Wendy, the caller that was talking about Cambridge Analytica and Facebook and talking about relatives versus the individual and relatives sharing things that the individual might not have. The individual...
Jen, I'm going to just jump. I'm sorry to jump on you, but we're coming up against a break. So we're coming up against the tyranny of the clock here. Hold that thought. We'll pick it up right after the break. Listeners, we're talking about DNA, privacy, and big questions. Among them, letting law enforcement, the private sector, use your personal DNA data to solve crimes, to make money. What concerns does this raise for you? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics Podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about a new, maybe an inevitable leap forward in the use of genetics, genealogy, to locate people through their relatives. You can join the conversation. When you sent your saliva sample into 23andMe or Ancestry.com, did you expect that your profile would be kept private? Did you tell your relatives what you were doing? Should you have? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Stephen Mercer, lawyer and law professor who has worked for 2 decades on DNA forensics and civil liberties, and Jennifer Wagner. She's a lawyer and bioethicist who focuses on DNA databanks and how they're used. And Jen, before the break, I cut you off. You're making an important point, but come back to that, please.
Sure. Thank you. So the point that I was making was that individual and collective rights are distinct, but both worthy of conversation. And often we get caught up in this individual right question, and we fail to think about those collective aspects. In terms of relatives and becoming genetic witnesses, you know, family members don't always disagree, and we might not want them to have a veto power over whether or not as an individual, we are able to participate in biomedical research or genetic research, or whether we're able to use some of these sites to explore our own genetic information in ways that that particular relative might not want to do. And so I think we need to think about both of those distinctly. And that was going to lead me to another point that I really wanted to make sure we had time to discuss a bit, and that's this issue of equal protection and minority rights. So currently, law enforcement databases, the official databases are heavily skewed. It's known in the system. It's biased against racial and ethnic minorities. Mm-hmm. And in the other space, the, you know, direct-to-consumer testing space and these genealogical resources, we know are not skewed in that fashion. They actually are skewed in the opposite direction, where typically it's white, European-American, European individuals who are relatively well-off financially who are in those systems. And so in many ways, law enforcement's desire to look to these resources to complement or supplement what they're able to study and investigate through the official law enforcement databases is an equalizer.
Interesting.
And I think that, you know, if we're thinking about equal protection under the law, which is not only something that our U.S. Constitution says is what should happen, but also the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I think we need to think about that and think about what situations are so important, what governmental interests are so important that we are willing to give a little bit of leeway where we wouldn't want other individuals, for example. And so I think in thinking through the terms of service that these sites have and, you know, the kind of ecosystem and culture that they're trying to develop for their users, we also need to think about when there might be exceptions to that, that we're willing to give law enforcement investigating these serious crimes some room to explore what we might not feel comfortable kind of just talking about explicitly.
So I want to talk. Go ahead, Steve, because
I had a slightly different take on Jen's comment. She's absolutely right that law enforcement databanks disproportionately impact minority groups and other disfavored members of our society. And perhaps what that suggests to us when they're not freely sending in their DNA samples is that they have a deeper appreciation of the dark side of DNA. I mean, it wasn't too long ago in our Western civilization where your ancestry and heredity would land you in a concentration camp. So I'm not so sure that we want to applaud private DNA databanks as equalizing the playing field when we're talking about something as like DNA, which has such a profound potential for misuse. And further, the idea that Liz, the last caller, raised that somehow there's a limitation on the use of private DNA databanks to investigating serious crimes who you would have no sympathy if one of your relatives committed. Understand something. Law enforcement collects DNA from non-serious crimes, trespass, rogue vagabond, quality of life, broken windows types offenses. Hmm. It's not just – DNA is not just found at serious crimes. And in fact, with – the swifter, more sensitive, cheaper technology of DNA analysis, touch DNA, is very common. And so it's not just fingerprints anymore. It's swabs of door handles and steering wheels and broken pieces of glass. And all of that means that, well, today we're applauding, you know, a serial rapist cold case being closed. What will be tomorrow? A serial litter bug?
Interesting.
I mean, in Singapore, that's what they do, is they collect DNA from discarded chewing gum to identify the culprits.
All right, Stephen Mercer, stand by with that thought, because this next sort of section of the conversation is related to that. I want to talk more about the sort of commercial use of DNA and where that leads. And let me introduce C.C. Moore. She's a genetic genealogist, maybe best known for her work on the PBS series Finding Your Roots with Henry Louis Gates Jr. She also has her own company, DNA Detectives, which helps people find long-lost relatives and biological families. And she joins us now from San Clemente, California. C.C. Moore, welcome. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So someone who works in this field, I'd love to get your sort of reaction to where we started this hour, and that was with the arrest of the alleged Golden State killer. How do you feel about this technology being put to this kind of use?
Well, I have two hats in this. I've got my personal hat, and I've got my community leader hat. Personally, I'm absolutely thrilled about it. I'm extremely proud that the techniques and methods that I helped to develop and promote have been used in such an amazing way and given so many people closure. However, on the community hat side of it, I have to say that it is somewhat of a concern to our community, because this was something that wasn't even on their radar, for the most part, except for maybe the most advanced genetic genealogists. It hadn't occurred to most people that by uploading their DNA to GEDmatch, that would open it up for law enforcement investigation. And I'll say the vast majority of the community is extremely supportive of law enforcement and this idea, and even really excited about it.
Yeah.
But there is a subset that feels like their privacy was invaded and worries about the slippery slope concept.
Well, respond to that. I mean, before I introduce you, Stephen Mercer sort of made this point that it's one thing when we can access these genealogical websites and catch someone like the Golden State Killer, but what happens when that slippery slope brings us to, I don't know, rounding up litter bugs or whatever it is? I mean, is that a concern of yours? And if so, how do you respond to that?
You know, I think everybody wants to catch a serial killer. That's fantastic. And because this is the first case that has gone public using genealogy databases to solve a case or use for law enforcement, the vast majority of people are enthusiastic about it and positive. But if it had been a different type of case that had been the first public case used in this way, there might have been a different reaction.
Got it. Let's go to a couple more callers. Sasha is calling from Columbus Junction, Iowa. Sasha, you're on the air. It's good to have you. Tell us what's on your mind.
Hi, Anthony. Hi to your guests. Long-time listener, for some caller, but I just felt the urge to call in. This conversation is a really neat intersection among three things I'm super passionate about. My familial ancestry, true crime, and the last conspiracy theories. Personally, I've had an ancestry DNA kit sitting on my desk. I was excited to get it about a year ago, but I never sent it in. I started reading and hearing a lot of different takes on this, what you're discussing now. And I guess my concern would be in 10 years or 15 or 20, when this craze kind of dies down and there's all this DNA sitting in a database, it's not just going to be accessible for, detectives to solve crimes anymore. A company owns this data, and it's not just my DNA. Along with my DNA, it's a lot of personal information about me. So what happens when this company decides to use my information and sell it to a third party?
All right, Sasha, it's a good point. We've sort of been talking a lot about that, but I mean, you raise sort of another area we can go into. Stephen Mercer, I'm sort of, in responding to Sasha, I mean, what other nefarious purposes or what nefarious purposes down the road could this stuff be used for that you've been thinking about?
Well, when you say nefarious, I mean, it you know, what may be nefarious to one may be the perfect day to another. Mm. I mean, take something like a designer baby. Someone who sends their DNA sample into Ancestry.com or 23andMe for the purpose of getting ancestry information may not be pleased to know that the company is using the DNA sample and other information in an aggregate way to develop designer baby options. And this is really the potential power of DNA and unlocking the secrets of the human genome is, you know, who's going to, from a policy perspective, really provide leadership and direction and control over how that gold mine of information is accessed. And one of the real concerns, and I think it's a very legitimate concern that Sasha raises, is that you have private companies that are going to have tens of millions and already have combined over 12 million DNA samples. And you're going to have large pharma companies that need access to huge databanks of DNA coupled with other information that is connected to one's ancestry. And how will that information be used? Is it going to be to develop vanity products? Is it going to be used to focus on longevity? Is it going to be used to focus on, allowing people to decide whether the embryo that's implanted has a propensity for athleticism?
Stephen Mercer, these are all good questions. And let me go to C.C. Moore, because she's someone within this community. C.C. Moore, how would you respond to the caller? I mean, you have a firm that uses data from other commercial DNA testing companies to help people find long lost relatives. I mean, are you holding on to this data for the long term for with other purposes in mind? I mean, respond to the caller.
Well, I don't store data. I'm using data from the commercial companies.
I see.
From GEDmatch.
Got it.
So, no, I wouldn't be holding on to that. I feel that there's different levels of privacy in our industry. The companies, the commercial companies like Ancestry.com and 23andMe, are putting a lot of resources into protecting their customers' privacy. And they give you quite a bit of control over your DNA. You get to decide if you opt into research or different uses. So I feel like when people test there, it really is secure and they've got a lot of control. But when you download that raw data, which they all give us that ability to do because we own our data, once you download it onto your desktop and you decide to go upload to a third-party site like GEDmatch, and there are some other sites as well, you lose control of it somewhat because you're taking it out of that structure of that billion-dollar company that has lots of protections and has a lot of reason to want to protect your data as well, and you're putting it on smaller sites. For instance, GEDmatch is a wonderful site, but it started by two citizen scientists back in 2010 who had absolutely no idea it would grow to be as big as it is. So they obviously don't have the same resources to protect people's privacy, obviously, that the big companies would.
Mm. Interesting.
So I've always been a big promoter of direct consumer DNA testing, of course, but over the last few years, I've certainly become more sensitive to encouraging people to do it, want people to really think about it, how much is privacy important to you. If it is really important, you might not be the right type of person to participate in this industry.
Right.
There's a lot to be gained for it.
And a lot to consider. Stand by, Cece. I want to go to at least one more caller here. Oliver is calling from Sarasota, Florida. Oliver, what's on your mind? Thank you for calling.
Hi, Anthony. What about the public service aspect of contributing your DNA to these databases? Why aren't we incentivizing and celebrating the contribution of by this person whose contribution resulted in the cracking of this case? Can they find that person and give him or her the reward money to celebrate and incentivize the contribution of other people's DNA so that law enforcement will have that tool be more productive to society?
Well, that's the flip side of this. Jen Wagner, what do you think about Oliver's point about celebrating this ability to use this amazing technology to crack serious crime?
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's a great point. Celebrating this in a way, public service or contribution to society, there's a little bit of a concern in suggesting that people have a duty to do this. I don't want to go that far, but I think contributions of this sort should be kind of recognized publicly. I did want to touch briefly on something, some points that Stephen had made, though. I worry about us thinking about DNA companies as, the boogeyman or genetic information information being the boogeyman and deterministic. And I just want to underscore a point I made earlier in the hour about this being a part of a conversation that's more broad about data and the digital world, because, you know, when Cece brought up her points of having various tiers of access, I think that's a good one to consider. And it's an interesting point that lends us to thinking more carefully about the need for public efforts, not just private industry. So when we're thinking about what do we know about the genome, honestly, we still know very, very little about the genome. You know, what we actually understand is just a fraction of what's in the genome. And often, when we're analyzing genomes, it leads to more questions and fewer answers. And so I think that there is a great need to think about ways to incentivize participation in genetic research, and there is a need to respect and properly fund public interest efforts like major efforts underway by the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, and others to try to understand that.
Well, it's a fascinating conversation, and depending on your point of view, it's a new world with lots of potential, or as Stephen, as you put it, it's the Wild West. But I want to thank my guest, Jen Wagner, Associate Director for Bioethics Research at Geisinger Health System. Jen, thanks so much for contributing to a really fascinating conversation. I'm very grateful.
Thank you.
I'm Stephen Mercer, lawyer and law professor who's worked for decades on DNA forensics and civil liberties. Steve, thank you as well.
You're welcome, Anthony.
Cece Moore is a genetic genealogist and founder of DNA Detective. Cece, it was a great pleasure having you as well.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.